The following is a lecture given by His Holiness Jayabhataka Swami on October 2nd, 1985 at New Taliban Farm in Carrier, Mississippi. The class begins with a reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 1, Text 4 through 5.
The great sage, Sukadeva Goswami, said, "My dear king, you have put before me an excellent question. Discourse is concerning the activities of the Lord, in which the glories of His devotees are also found, are extremely pleasing to devotees. Such wonderful topics always counteract the miseries of the materialistic way of life. Therefore, great sages like Narada always speak upon Srimad Bhagavatam, because it gives one the facility to hear and chant about the wonderful activities of the Lord. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto Srila Vyasadeva and then begin describing topics concerning the activities of Lord Hari." In this verse, Sukadeva Goswami offers his respectful obeisances, Krishnaya Munaye, which means to Krishna Dvaipayana Vyasa. One must first offer one's respectful obeisances to one's spiritual master. Sukadeva Goswami's spiritual master is his father, Vyasa Deva, and therefore he first offers his respectful obeisances to Krishna Dvaipayana Vyasa, and then begins describing topics of Lord Hari. Whenever there is an opportunity to hear about the transcendental activities of the Lord, we must take it. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu recommends Kirtaniya Sada Hari. One should always engage in Krishna Katha by chanting and talking about Krishna and hearing about Him. That is the only occupation of a Krishna conscious person. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of Canto 7, Chapter 1, Text 4 and 5. In the chapter entitled, "The Supreme Lord is Equal to Everyone." So, it's described that Sukadeva Goswami achieved perfection simply by speaking the Bhagavatam. And that Parikshit Maharaj achieved perfection simply by hearing the Bhagavatam. So here Sukadeva Goswami is congratulating the king for asking such pertinent and wonderful questions. Someone who preaches, they know that how blissful it is, but someone asks pertinent questions about Krishna. So often when you preach in the West, people walk up and the only question they can ask is, "What is that white thing on your face? Do everybody have to have short hair?" And so on and so forth. So if someone actually comes up and says, "What is even, you know, just some, tell me, what is the reason why the devotees appear so happy when they chant Hare Krishna? Is there something really, you know, even just, you know, something like that?" You think, "Well, this is wonderful." So here, Maharaj Parikshit, he's asking, you know, such a nice questions that those questions are opening the gateway for Sukadeva Goswami to go higher and higher in the descriptions of Krishna Katha. So it requires both a good listener as well as a qualified speaker, and then you can have proper discourses. With this combination, then everything is perfect. So, here we have the perfect speaker and the perfect listener, Sukadeva Goswami and Maharaj Parikshit. Maharaj Parikshit asks the perfect questions, and Sukadeva Goswami is giving the absolute perfect answers. Similarly, I was present in Mayapur when Prabhupada was having those perfect questions, perfect answers. And Prabhupada was sitting there in the grass hut, in his little bhajan kuti. And he was preaching to different people. And so when this Peace Corps student came by asking various questions, then Prabhupada was explaining Krishna consciousness to him. So this is a common feeling by any preacher. If they get a good question, if they get a question that shows the person's actually interested in knowing something about spiritual life, this is very encouraging. Because primarily people, they're only concerned with the materialistic aspect of life. They don't even think or don't even have hardly any inclination towards knowing more about spiritual life due to a bodily concept of life. So this question is very spiritual, whether Narayan is partial or impartial, how he is dealing with his devotees. This opens the door for some very high-level discussions. So in this way, when I first joined the temple, I asked for some clue, you know, what was when I was going to see Prabhupada. One devotee told me that it's going to be very hard for you to understand what he says because he has an Indian accent. So better you just stay in this temple and help us out doing Sankirtan, whatever, and don't go there. It's the president, of course. Another devotee told me that, well, don't listen to him. If you offered him the fare, he'd go with you too. So just go to see Srila Prabhupada. You'll be able to make out. And that devotee told me that the good thing is always ask good questions. Always try to ask a pertinent question. So I remember that was one of the only and first advices I'd ever got from anybody. So every time when Prabhupada gave a class at the end, I'd raise my hand and I'd try to ask a question. Usually I'd get smashed. And the one time I asked something, what about the gopis? And he said, just try to understand, just try to become Krishna conscious. So I thought that I was actually being more of a botheration, and I would have to go and work every night because that time was a great economical difficulty. I couldn't attend Prabhupada's classes at one point. The next day I would listen to the tapes. And then after the class, one day Srila Prabhupada asked that, where is Jayapataka? He said, oh, he's out. He has to work now because of to bring in money for the temple. And Prabhupada said, oh, he asked very nice questions. He would smash me when I asked, but Prabhupada didn't usually praise anyone to their face, but sometimes he did. So we can see that asking questions was something that very pleasing to preachers. And to be able to ask a good question, a person has to also come up to that level of understanding of the subject matter that they can coherently form an appropriate question. That means that even to ask a question, a person has to listen very carefully. Unless a person listens, then they're not going to be able to ask subsequently a relevant question. So, Lord Chaitanya, note that how he did a lot of his preaching simply by asking questions. He asked questions to Ramananda Rai, which were so pertinent that they got Ramananda Rai to go higher and higher and higher and to explain Krishna consciousness in the most exalted levels. In fact, Lord Chaitanya kept asking such questions that it forced Ramananda Rai to come out with topics which had never been disclosed before. He said he had never had anyone ask him to explain those topics, those highest topics of Krishna consciousness ever before. So sometimes even a preacher may start to ask questions for a particular purpose. We know that when Prabhupada would be preaching to, say, Christians or other people, sometimes he would, rather than just say something to them, where they sometimes wouldn't listen, he would start to counter by asking them questions. And this is the way that Lord Chaitanya defeated Keshav Kashmiri. Keshav Kashmiri came and he said, "Oh, my young student, very nice to see you." He said, "You are a well-known scholar. I have come here to debate with you and to defeat you." And the Lord Chaitanya said, "Oh, I'm just like your student. I am just like your student. I'm just very, Nabalak. I'm just a very infant in this field. I'm just studying a little grammar. I haven't really, I've heard so much about your poetic prowess. Could you kindly compose some verses so I could be able to enjoy your Sanskrit compositions?" And of course, Keshav Kashmiri, just like a hurricane, he rattled off 100. He just not by memory, but as he was composing, just like that. You know how it is if you ever have to write a Vyas Puja and you want to write a poem, even in English, it takes hours and maybe even days. For some people, it may take weeks just to try to make up a proper, what we consider to be even a somewhat offerable Vyas Puja offering. But here he's rattling off poetry in Sanskrit. So great was his knowledge of Sanskrit that he could compose just like that, nearly perfect, not exactly, but to an ordinary person's ear it would have certainly appeared perfect, Sanskrit verses. Of course, Lord Chaitanya's ear was, being Krishna himself, he immediately could remember all the 100 verses that he said, and he picked out like number 57 in the middle. Even though Keshav Kashmiri couldn't have repeated those same verses again. He just was composing and keeping track how many, but even he, I doubt, could have again repeated exactly all those 100 verses. He was surprised that amongst the 100, just hearing it like that, how Lord Chaitanya got number 57. Or whichever number it happened to be. It's right in the middle. Lord Chaitanya says, "Well, some are great composers and some are sutidhar. Some are able to immediately remember something when they hear it. So, I may have that quality. It's not very important, my guys." So then he asked, "Could you kindly explain the good qualities and the defects in your poetry?" The loaded question. What defect? There are no defects in my poetry. My poetry is flawless. Was the immediate sentiment that Keshav Kashmiri espoused. And then, of course, Lord Chaitanya, he first said, "Well, I can explain to you the good and bad qualities." And first he glorified all of the good qualities. Then he started to pick out the various bad qualities that were there. And this way, Keshav Kashmiri, simply by being asked appropriate questions, he kind of hung himself without Lord Chaitanya. It's kind of like when Krishna ran from the battlefield as Ranchor, then he got the Javana Raja, Kala Yavana, to get himself destroyed by running head-on into the cave where Muchukundu was. So, in a similar way, this is the way that is recommended in preaching sometimes to Mayavadis or to different people, is not to just go on you speaking and they speak, they don't listen to what you say, and it becomes a totally breakdown of communication. But knowing how to ask, knowing exactly where their weak points are, exactly where the defects in their philosophy is, and hitting right to their Achilles heel by asking that exact question for which you know they don't have the answer. That is a wonderful thing of Krishna consciousness, that practically speaking, there's no question that can be asked that there's not the answer for that in a basic philosophical context. So, therefore, in fact, when I was in Chile, there we had some nuns and people who are chanting also, and they invited me to see the bishop. So when I went to see the bishop, I saw his urban renewal center. And I met the head theologian of the Roman Catholic Church in Santiago. And we had a nice discussion how the Mormons were not actually preaching God consciousness and a few other things. And then they took me on a tour. And in our discussions, because of just even though you don't have such a vast knowledge of Krishna consciousness, but the basic understanding still is so much more than what even normal religious or priestly people know in terms of God consciousness and spiritual consciousness, that one of the nuns there commented when we were going on the tour that it seems as if they've come to take over. And later on, the priests and nuns who were chanting with said that we were very surprised that everyone from the bishop down to all the other nuns, as soon as they heard that Krishna conscious devotees were coming, they all became very afraid. Because they knew that if we asked questions, they wouldn't have the answers. And they've never been able to ask a question for which you didn't have the answer. But this is, you know, naturally because of the whole, you know, the big black robes or the colorful robes and the white, you know, you get kind of psyched out that these are, but they don't actually have the answers to so many questions. They don't even know what questions to ask, and there's not, practically speaking, there's not any question they could ask for which the answer has not been provided in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. So wonderful are Parikshit Maharaj's questions and Sukadeva Goswami's answers that all the topics needed for understanding spiritual life have been very thoroughly covered. Of course, there's no end to it. They can be more and more expanded, but basic topics are all touched on in these in the Bhagavad Gita and in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, and so on. So, this is a very important point to know this science of questions and answers. Sometimes people don't ask questions, and they have to be taught by probing them, by asking them questions. Sometimes a disciple goes before the spiritual master, and obviously the disciple appears to be in the modes of material nature, and the spiritual master asks the disciple, what is wrong, or how is everything? Okay. Then you have to, you know, start to ask various questions, then things start to come out that maybe everything is not okay. There are various doubts and various things that are on the mind which are to be eradicated. So this is actually one of the principal things that Lord Krishna mentioned to Arjuna, that every disciple, that every devotee is supposed to do. Tad vidhi pratipatena pratiprasnena sevaya. Pratiprasnena means to ask questions. This is one of the four. Pratipatena is surrender, sevaya is serve, prasnena is to ask questions, and upadesh means to listen to the answers. It's one of the four things that a disciple is supposed to do when approaching a spiritual master, or that any devotee is supposed to perform. So sometimes people, due to not fully concentrating on the subject matter, no questions come up in their mind. Actually, one should force oneself to try to understand the subject matter and then naturally try to pick out appropriate questions so that the subject matter can be properly understood. Unless one is able to ask questions and then understand the answers, then in the future, one will not be able to preach. For instance, when Lord Chaitanya went to South India, there's a slight difference between the Vishishtadvaita philosophy of Ramanuja Acharya and the Achintya Veda Veda Tattva philosophy of Lord Chaitanya. Ramanuja Acharya, in his conclusions of Vishishtadvaita, they lead one to the understanding of the position of Narayana. But he never expounded exactly on the position of Lord Krishna. So the followers of Ramanujacharya, the Sri Sampradaya, they came to the conclusion that Narayana is supreme. And therefore, because between the Ramanuja Sampradaya and the Shankaracharya Sampradaya, in India, a lot of people consider that Krishna is the incarnation of Vishnu, when it's not actually the fact. But because some of these Sampradayas have got that general idea, they don't know exactly whether it's Krishna or Vishnu or Narayan, who comes first, or which is the supreme form of Vishnu in these various Sampradayas. Or they consider that it's Narayana. You see. Although there are other so many proofs, Iswaraha Paramaha Krishna Satchidananda Vigharadiyadi Govinda Sarvakarana Karanam, or just like Ete Chang Sakalapum San Krishna Stu Bhagavan Swayam, that Krishna is the original personality of Godhead and the others are simply his part or his kola, part of his part. So sometimes the pujaris or the brahmanas in South India would kind of heckle Lord Chaitanya and tell him that your Krishna is expansion of Narayana. He's subordinate to Narayana. So then Lord Chaitanya, he would very cleverly say, well, yes, all right, if that's so, then can you kindly answer me one question? Kindly give me the answer to one question. But why is it that if Krishna is subordinate to Narayana, that means that Narayana must have everything that Krishna has plus more, then why is it that Lakshmi Devi is doing tapasya in order to enter into Krishna's Rasa Leela? And the brahmanas in South India, they're trying to figure that one out. And they are getting, you know, tilt signs, because there was no answer coming out. That if Narayana is all-encompassing, more than if Krishna is included within the personality of Narayana, then why would Lakshmi have to go outside of Narayana's relationship to independently contact Krishna? Doesn't make any sense. And then, it's just like when those, you know, boxing champs, they give the, you know, person's like stunned, and just, you know, then they give him another one, you know, and that's the KO, the knockout blow. Then Lord Chaitanya, while they're still, you know, spinning, then he'd say, and then just one other question. Why is it that Lakshmi Devi was refused to be admitted into the Rasa Leela? And then they are devastated. You see, so they didn't have the answer. So if you can ask someone a question for which they don't have the answer, then, well, in these kind of spiritual discussions, then it means that they have to surrender to that extent to, all right, hear what your answer is. So then, of course, Lord Chaitanya explained that because Narayana is included within Krishna, but Krishna is not included within Narayana. Krishna has more qualities than Narayana. He has the very super sweet four additional qualities than Narayana. Krishna has 64 qualities and Narayana has 60. Krishna is in the madhurya, in the very intimate in the madhurya rasa, or in the higher spiritual rasas of spontaneous love, where Narayana is being worshipped in the rasas of majesty, respect, and opulence, and so on. So, and namely Santan Dasya and respectful Sakya Rasa. In the respectful relationships of neutrality, servitude, and friendship with respect. But Krishna is specifically, in addition, he's worshipped rather with the very intimate friendship, parental, and conjugal loving mellows. So, Krishna personality possesses these higher characteristics. So in this way, Lord Chaitanya was able to, if nothing else, Everyone stayed away from him with these topics, knowing that they didn't have the answers and that Lord Chaitanya did. And many were, the sincere ones were rather convinced by his discussions that in fact Krishna was the supreme form of Narayana or the supreme Vishnu form. Well, even though we have these slight differences, as Maharaj was saying yesterday, that because we're all Vaishnavas, so we have mutual respect, and the Prabhupada said that actually we don't have any real bones to grind. We don't have any real real problem between ourselves because we all believe in the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, that is enough for us to be all Vaishnavas. In this regard, are all considered to be one family. Although there may be this slight difference that one may be a little bit pro-Narayan and someone pro-Krishna, this we is an internal matter which we take care of amongst ourselves. But the Vaishnavas are versus all the others who are believing in other less perfect understandings of the Absolute Truth. This is something like, in the Mahabharata explains that how the five Pandavas and the 100 sons of Dhritarashtra, they're always having so many rivalries. But they're all considered part of the Kuru dynasty, of the great Kuru empire, which was at that time the empire of practically the whole world. So when they were, Kurus were being attacked by the Gandharvas, when the Pandavas were in the forest in exile, then they are being defeated by the Gandharvas. And Bhima found it, and he thought, this is our great chance. We can now see all the Kurus destroyed. But the Yudhisthira, he gave the ruling, no, we have to go to their rescue. That our family people are being attacked by outsiders. That amongst ourselves, we are 100 against 5. But against others, we are 105 against the world. And so then they came and they defeated the Gandharvas. So, between the time of Jiva Goswami, he wanted to have a Vishwa Vaishnava Raja Sabha amongst all the Vaishnavas of the world. And Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he actually established such a Vishwa Vaishnava Raja Sabha in North and South India. And of course, after Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur left because of various whatever problems they had in the Gaudiya Math, they were not able to keep this Vishwa Vaishnava Raja Sabha. Vishwa means the worldwide, Vaishnava means of course the devotees of Vishnu, the Supreme Person of Godhead. The Raj Sabha means the king of conferences, or the best of the topmost assembly. But apart from maybe some namesake they might have somewhere, it's not functioning anymore. So we can hope that in the future, one time in Vrindavan, Prabhupada said that you bring all the Vaishnavas and feed them. First, the prasad distribution should be made to the Vaishnav devotees. And then after that, to others. So, in the future, we could hope that there'd be a unity amongst these various Vaishnavas from all over India, all over the world. So, at least with some type of a coordinating committee as envisioned by Jiva Goswami, a Vishwa Vaishnava Raja Sabha. So, amongst the Vaishnava, although we're united, even amongst us, there may be some difference of opinion. But in our preaching, we have to know exactly what is the difference. It said that for one to be a bona fide spiritual master, they should know and be able to explain what is the difference between the Advaita, the Sudha Advaita, Dvaita Advaita, Dvaita, Vishista Dvaita, and the Chinta Veda Veda Tattva philosophy. They should be able to know what each of the principal Munis, Rishis, Acharyas, and their philosophies are, be able to explain the difference and be able to show the weak and the strong point. Just like there are people, they study for days and days videotapes of their opponent boxers. Where are their weak points? Where is this, that, where? All right, he's got an eye that easily bleeds. And then they just, all of a sudden, they start pounding on his eye when they're in the fight until it bleeds and the fight's canceled and he gets a technical knockout. You have to win the fight somehow or another. In debating or in trying to preach Krishna consciousness, we have to know exactly where all the people stand. Then only can you go out there and defend your philosophy, because they're doing the same thing. You see, but unfortunate for us is Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy doesn't have any weak points. We just have to know the philosophy. If we know it properly and know where their weak points are, then we won't have any difficulty. So all these things, again, are kind of dug out by asking the appropriate question and answer. When one is in a situation where they preach and someone asks a question, you don't know the answer, then a Madhya Madhakari devotee will not lose faith, but will know that although I don't know the answer, my guru or some senior Vaishnava, they know the answer, and I can go to them and get the answer. So this ability or this kind of deep faith, where even sometimes one might get stuck up and not know the proper answer in preaching, but they don't lose their faith and they go and find out the answer and then they can reply it later. When a preacher is preaching and someone starts to counter with various questions and preach, and the person actually becomes bewildered and then starts to overtly doubt, so really, is that true? You know? And then later on they go, so maybe it's not, let me just check up. But they've actually, at that point, they were technically defeated. And they didn't know the answer, and they actually, that time, they became bewildered. That is a symptom of a Kanishtha Adhikari. But even a Kanishtha Adhikari, deep in their heart, they don't feel that any non-Krishna conscious conclusion, it ultimately doesn't satisfy them. And again, they come back to the stronger devotees and get the matter cleared up. So these are, and there's someone who knows the answers, who's able to properly explain according to the Sadhu Shastra and the Guru, is considered to be at the level of a Uttamadhikari. So, or is an Uttamadhikari. Today we've discussed about questions. And actually, question and answers, it's an unlimited topic. It's so important that although we just got to first base in one sense that we're just discussing questions, but it's in a spiritual life, it's such a broad topic that literally speaking, one could go on discussing all the wonderful questions that have been asked throughout history, like questions like when Narada Muni was about to be massacred by the Dasu, the dacoit, Ratnakar. And he just asked him one question, that who is sharing your sinful reaction? Just one line, a one-liner that devastated. He said, well, my wife, my mother, my father, my kid, everyone, who else? I'm killing and murdering and bringing them the wealth. They're sharing it with me. You go and ask them. Of course, he went and nobody wanted to share the bad karma with him. They all said, we're dependent. Why don't you get a job? Why don't you do something else? You're not giving, you know, whatever. They all had their pat answers. No one person wanted to share the bad karma with Ratnakar. By hitting one good question, Narada Muni was able to completely bring him around, and then he initiated him and made him Valmiki Muni. So like this, there literally we could go on for unlimited time discussing wonderful questions that were asked either by great devotees or by a spiritual master to force someone to start thinking of areas they had never thought of before. Sometimes people are just asleep. They don't want to hear. They haven't started thinking about these things, and it requires just like agitating their gray matter, agitating their brain by some appropriate questions to force them to start thinking. Prabhupada would just sit in the Calcutta temple and people would come in and he would just fire at them, what is the purpose of life? People, all the very aristocratic Indians would say, wow, there's so many People say so many things. No, but what do you say, Prabhupada? What do you say? What is the purpose? Well, I mean, some people... No, what do you think? Well, I don't exactly know. No. And then, you know, then Prabhupada would start to explain what is the purpose of life. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki. Jai Parikshit Maharaj ki. Sukadev Goswami ki. Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Gopremanandi. Any question? Yes? Yeah, you can read the teachings of Lord Chaitanya to know about those philosophies. Prabhupada has discussed something about those philosophies in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. I said there's a qualification that when a person is going to become an acharya and has to represent the disciplic succession off of Vyasa-san, that at that time he should be able to defend the philosophies. Prabhupada has said that. It's not that every brahmachari or bhakta or just first, you know, that has to immediately know those particular philosophies. But when one is going to be in a position where they have to defend the disciplic succession from Vyasa-san, which means he's basically representing Vyasa, I mean, the acharyas or other leading preachers of those sects won't expect every devotee to know, even they don't have their followers know all these intricacies. But they probably would expect the acharyas to know. And if the acharya doesn't know, then it would be kind of a defamation of the sampradaya. So that's something that after you read all of Prabhupada's books and you get the basic understanding, even of those four, five philosophies are given in teachings of Lord Chaitanya. They're all mentioned there and they're basically discussed. Then if more understanding is needed, then of course there could be understood. In fact, Prabhupada wanted to have the six sandarvas of Jiva Goswami translated. And in the six sandarvas of Jiva Goswami, it is so expertly presented that anyone who reads these six sandarvas, they have to accept our Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy. And the Prabhupada said he didn't know who could translate them. I was trying to encourage Acharya Dev that if he could translate those. Prabhupada said that actually that's the most important works in our disciplic succession. But unfortunately, as of yet, no one has translated them into the English language. But they, from every point of view, from every angle, from every philosophical point, they explain Krishna consciousness. So like that, Prabhupada, a few books like this, Prabhupada said they could be translated. They're definitely a postgraduate thing for our understanding of our preaching. And in the future, hopefully some preachers will, or some Krishna conscious scholar may translate these, but it's not in the West, I mean, there's not very many people come up and discuss Vishishta Dvaita or something like that. Primarily in India, or when discussing with Indian philosophers, it might be somewhat necessary. But basically, these arguments I told you today, Lord Chaitanya, these are the arguments that you have to know to counter the Vishishta Dvaita philosophy. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, when Lord Chaitanya discussed with the Tattvavadis, that shows how the Dvaitists came off. And basically, even the books we have, these things, if you really, after reading it 2-3 times, all the Prabhupada books, then you start, you know, after you get the basic understanding, there are further and further deeper realizations you get in reading Prabhupada's books. It's not that, well, I read the Bhagavatam one time, that you've gone as deep as you can go. Perhaps you can hear the topics unlimitedly, and you can go deeper and deeper. And then these philosophies are actually discussed here and there throughout Prabhupada's books, sometimes by name and sometimes not by name, but just by the philosophy. And
once one knows basically the philosophy, you can recognize that Prabhupada is now discussing against the stabda dvaita, just the advaita philosophy. Now he's speaking in comparison to this philosophy. Prabhupada has given us arguments for these philosophies, but he didn't always name the philosophy as such. Some of the concepts are common to two or three of the philosophies. Some impersonal ideas are common both to Advaita philosophy and to Buddhism. For instance. Yes? Bhagavatam was the last Purana to be written. After the Bhagavatam, he didn't write any more Puranas. In the very beginning of the Bhagavatam, it explained that Vyasadeva was feeling dissatisfied, although he'd written so many Puranas, because he was feeling dissatisfied, and he asked Narada Muni why. And Narada Muni told him, because you glorified all the demigod worship, this worship, that, so many other things, but you've never given the straight nectar about pure devotional service to the Lord, to Vishnu, to Krishna. So that's why then he wrote spoke the Srimad Bhagavatam. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is the essence of all Puranas, the essence of the ripened fruit of the entire Vedic literature. And it is the last of all the Puranas to be written. Hare Krishna.